Thanks for tuning in. You won't be disappointed. The next hour is one of the most expansive and enlightening conversations of my life. I'm joined by Alistair Henderson of BAM and formerly of the FPS. First, here comes a message from our sponsors.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
It's my delight to welcome to the FPS podcast one of our previous chairs, Alistair Henderson. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Steve. How are you?
Well, not great physically. Unfortunately, I have succumbed to COVID, bouncing back quite well, but and strong enough to have this conversation with you today, I'm really pleased to say. But great to have you with us. And what we'd like to do today is talk a little bit about your career history, about your passions and what you're currently doing with BAM. I know that you know all sorts of different aspects of things going on in this industry, and it's going to be a really interesting conversation. As a previous chair of the Federation of Piling Specialists, I think it'd be interesting for our listeners to learn a little bit about where you've come from and your journey through the geotechnical world and how you came to have the position that you've not now got within the industry and within your company.
I trained as a civil engineer, but with a geology degree added on to that. So my background is, in education terms, is very much ground engineering or geotechnical engineering geology. I had a job interview in my third year and took a summer placement with BAM Nuttall, the civil engineering contracting business, and they more or less straight away said, the place you need to be is BAM Ritchie's, which is our specialist geotechnical division. So I joined them for a summer. I did a further summer with them, the longest job interview in history, I think. And then I joined as an assistant geotechnical engineer. And I have to tell you, Steve, that is the only job interview I've had in my life. So I started with BAM Ritchie's full-time in 1996 and just progressed through the various things that you do. I became a geotechnical engineer, was running projects, ground investigation projects, geotechnical projects. I did a placement in Gibraltar in 2000 for a slope stabilisation, a very big soil nailing job that we did in Gibraltar. I came back to a role running planning for the Ritchie's division, moved on, became responsible for bidding for the division, became the engineering manager for the division, and then ultimately the divisional director, so the managing director, if you like, of BAM Ritchie's. So BAM Ritchie's is a wholly owned subsidiary of BAM Nuttall, but it runs effectively as a business in itself. After, gosh, 5 or 6 years of running in that MD role, I was invited to join the executive board of BAM Nuttall. And that was an interesting invitation, because as you shift from that world of project management and very direct operational management to executive board world, things change. You stop getting all the fun of projects and you start getting involved in some other kind of things, which are, I have to say, also fun. So a lot of corporate function things. I took on particular responsibility for people, but I would describe that as the whole sort of human experience within the organisation. So, you know, how we identify the kind of people that we want, how we identify what it is we want, how we bring them into the organisation, how we make sure they're safe in our organisation through operational activity and otherwise, how we grow and develop and improve them, give them skills that come back and feed into the productivity of the business, how they leave the business, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes not so, and how we stay in touch with the sort of diaspora of BAM people outside the organisation.
Well, I'm really interested in people, and we will talk a lot more about that in this podcast, but I'm wondering about your earlier stages and how you progressed to that divisional director position. And you did all these little bits of roles within the business. Was it all set up? It seemed like it was all geared to getting you into that MD type position by you picking up all the different bits of experience, because certainly from my career journey, what I found was really beneficial was doing the technical stuff, doing the commercial stuff, doing the contracts management. Was there a grand design within BAM to manage somebody that they'd identified as a future leader in that way? Or was that something that you had within your own mind that...
I think if you'd asked me at the time, I would have told you there wasn't a grand plan. I guess knowing what I know now and how we develop people and how we create opportunity for people, there was obviously something going on. But I suppose without trying to undermine too much what I preach to other people, at that time, I was interested in the things I was interested in. I found a lot of things interested in. You go towards things. So, you know, having a, I suppose, what we call a growth mindset, this idea that it is worth trying new things, it's worth experimenting, it's worth giving effort to new adventures, learning something from them and seeing how you develop, really just as a sort of experimental approach to what is interesting, what grows you. That is invaluable. And it's the difference, you know, that is a big difference you find in populations. Those who have that outlook of, okay, let's give it a try. It might not work, but it might. And those who are resistant to the idea of trying. Being open to the idea of trying things, being open to experimentation has done me everything about my career. It's effectively led me to do what I do. So I took the opportunities that were there. I was fortunate enough to be in the place that I could take those opportunities because, as you know, construction can be a business where you are 300 miles from home, working 7 days a week and working 14 hours a day. We do less of that now, thankfully, but it's still a difficult industry to be in. So it's hard to reconcile with family commitments, for example. As I moved through that, you know, those opportunities presented, I took them and I tried to do, at the time, I tried to do the best thing I could do. That really, you know, if we get into advice stage, this is what I say to people. Just don't worry about this politics thing. Don't worry about this advancement thing. I find people who've got their sort of life plan nailed out and marked down in a chart, I find that quite intimidating, to be quite honest. I find that quite off-putting. The most interesting people I know don't know what they want to do with the rest of their life. I'm kind of in that place myself. A lot of the things you find day to day, you focus on trying to help people in the moment, trying to move things on, getting a sense of how things could be better, and always striving for something to be better than it is just now, even if it's really good, but just trying to make it better than it is just now.
To provide a little bit of balance there, as somebody that probably does write down a lot of ideas and visions, I do find it beneficial to visualise where I want to be with my business or in my personal life, and maybe put a few staging posts down. But you're right about failure, because I think you've got to accept failure as potentially something that's going to happen on the route to success. I mean, that really is how we learn things, and you've got to try new things as well. You've got to get out of that comfort zone and expand my skill set and try this. I know I'm not going to be right at it first time, and I think that's where it's important that you work within a supportive environment that appreciate that and are ready to sort of catch you when you fall and make sure the impact of those micro failures aren't really going to be detrimental for what your business is providing as well.
So a lot of that is about how you create the environment for work, not just the work you're doing on a given day, but also the environment that allows people to understand, you know, failure is expensive in our industry and we're not very tolerant of failure, but you describe them as micro failures. The ability to try something and have it not succeed in the way that you thought it might has to be there. If you don't allow people to experiment or you don't allow them to try new things, they cannot develop. Even if they want to develop, they can't develop. I have to say, having been deeply disrespectful about people who write down their career plans, there does come a point, and it came upon me, you know, fairly late in my career, when I became managing director of BAM Ritchies, that felt like a normal sort of progression because it was a business I was familiar with. When somebody taps you on the shoulder and says, come and do something quite different, and of course now I do that with Royal BAM Group, the big mothership, you do start, you know, at that time you're already thinking a bit more strategically and you already start looking at these things. So you start to shape, okay, what is it you're trying to do? What experience is worth getting? What, from your own point of view, from a development point of view, is a structured way to grow beyond the thing that you are otherwise quite single-minded or single-tracked about? So for me, it was operational exposure, business exposure, that got me to the managing director part. And then you enter this corporate world where you see, yes, you step away from the things that you're used to, you step away from the things that you have traditionally associated as being your good things, and you step into an environment where you're asked to do things that you've never been trained to do, that you have to try and figure out what the best thing is for the business and head in that direction. You're learning as you go. You're trying to pull from other organizations, see what they do. You're trying to find best practice, and all of it in an environment that isn't necessarily your sort of natural place that you grew up in, thinking that this was my childhood dream, I will end up here. But I have to say, it's fascinatingly interesting. You know, you get to a place where, as a big business, the ability to help people do their work and do it better.
I've known you probably 10 years or more. You've always been great with people. So I suppose it was a natural progression for you to focus on that side of things. You mentioned, though, you didn't really get any sort of formal qualifications around that.
So like a lot of organisations, we do internally a great deal of management and leadership development training. And as you become more advanced in your career, more senior, it becomes more focused, more detailed, more extensive. So there's a lot comes from that. You know, it's interesting, when I do personality tests, and I guess in my world, that's a thing that seems to happen fairly often. They're always really interesting. Somebody trying to tell you what they think you should know about yourself. I suppose you have to understand that these are not a truth. They're an aspect of your personality, and you can look at them and understand, what can I take from this that strengthens me? What can I look at and say, well, that maybe I don't recognise this? It's good for finding blind spots in who you are. And all of those tests come out and say that I'm not that good with people. That people is not the first thing in my head. So that's I find that really interesting. But you know, what I do just now is a big corporate role in a big organisation, and it's banded under HR. But actually, what it is talking about how you get people performance at the heart of business performance. Our businesses, our operational business, cannot perform unless our people are skilled, motivated, and more than that, just, you know, growing, adding capability. If they're the same tomorrow as they were yesterday in terms of their capability, then our overall productivity isn't increasing, our capability isn't increasing. So there's an aspect of it that is moral. How do you help people grow and become good individuals? And there's an aspect of it that is deeply business-centric. How do you make sure that these people, these key resources that you rely on, are growing and they're...
Yeah. So it's, you know, it becomes, well, one of the key things there is getting them excited about what you're doing. So they've got to buy into the vision for your business and the values of your business, but also get them really excited about what they're doing at work. And from what I know about you're very effective at doing that. So Alistair, you we obviously, in preparation for the podcast, we're talking what we'd like to discuss, and you put forward under a sort of general head a purpose-led business. That's quite a broad term, isn't it? It encompasses a lot of things. Do you want to just explain what you mean by that?
So we were talking a moment ago about how you motivate people. What motivates people to do the things they do? And as I would go around the Nuttall business, the BAM Riches business, the BAM business more widely, I would ask people, what's the purpose of our business? And I have to say that 75%, sometimes 80% of the population would wheel round and say, to make money. Making money is definitely a thing that we do as a business. We're a contractor. You need the money in order to do the things you do. It's part of what our shareholders look at in terms of return. But the truth is, our organization, its purpose is not to make money. Its purpose is to deliver value to society. It makes money as a product of that, and the making money part is really, really important. Unless we do that, we can't fulfill our purpose. But when you say to people, look, if our purpose is making money, we're sitting here, we make whatever it is, you know, a typical construction margin somewhere between 0 and 2%, sometimes sub-zero. Our purpose was to make money. We should go and take all our cash and stick it on tech stocks, because that will make us an awful lot more money than trying to build the things that we are building just now. And when you get people past that point of it's about the money, and you start talking to them about, well, why are you doing what you're doing? What is it that you're interested in? What you find, or what I find within those populations, is that almost to a person, their interest is in leaving the place that they've come to do a project, leaving that better than they found it. They're fiercely proud of the things they're constructing. Sometimes, you know, they haven't been designing them, they haven't been the person that's developed it or conceptualized it, but they're turning up to change a place, to create a change.
That's the same whether it's because you're, I think you're based in the Netherlands now, aren't you? That's the same in the Netherlands, in the UK, it's all around the world.
You must have it with your own people, Steve, when you speak to them and talk to them about the job they're doing. The passion they show in telling you about, you ask them, you know, you turn up, you know what a rig looks like, you know what the augers look like, you know what the guys look like, and you talk to them and you say, tell me about what you're doing. And it's a half-hour conversation, and they want to tell you every detail. Let me tell you about the fluids we're using. Let me tell you what we're doing with the muck. You know, And this rig, I'll tell you all the problems about this rig. They care about what they're doing and they care about making a difference. Yeah. So purpose-led business really is about the sort of broader understanding of why our industry exists and why it's useful to society and how, A, we can make money as part of that, because that's an important part, as I said, of our sustainability as a business, but how it starts to change the way you think about how you procure projects, how you deliver projects, what those projects are for. In a bigger picture setting, when you talk to people like the National Infrastructure Commission, how we select the kind of infrastructure that we should be building as a society. And all these things start to come together under this banner of purpose-led business. Now, you hear it talked about in all sorts of ways. So often in the context of capitalism, so I'm a capitalist, you're a capitalist, we all work and we make money. Milton Friedman, shareholder capitalism. It's all about enriching the shareholder. Increasingly these days you hear the language of stakeholder capitalism. So it's about achieving the purpose and giving reward to shareholders on the basis of having achieved that purpose.
There's some countries out there now that are saying, let's not value what we're doing based on GDP. Let's look at sort of well-being and happiness factors as well. And I suppose it's applying that sort of principle to a business as well.
And also, you know, one of those key things that gives people that sense of well-being is having a sense of direction, feeling that they are progressing towards something. When people feel aimless or directionless, they find it very difficult to be motivated, and they find it difficult to be concentrated on what they're doing and to feel good about what they're doing. And you give people direction, you give them clarity, you give them that sense of progress in themselves. They make themselves feel better. You don't have to do an awful lot more than that.
Well, you've always been a great advocate for training, haven't you? I think about RoJEP is something that you've pushed with Jim Shields as well, with him, Bamrich's, who's instrumental in that. Why is that so important to you?
Well, that's a very natural consequence of the idea that if you're working in our industry and you care about what you do, then that's a professional attitude to work. And we do an awful lot of work. You guys are exactly the same. You train, you teach, you develop your people at every level in the organisation because it's a good thing to do for people, but mainly because it's a good business thing to do. It gives you additional capacity. The training has a purpose. It's to improve your capability, improve your capacity, have a positive impact on the productivity of your business. So you do it for a purpose. And as you go through that, you find these individuals, they don't just have a job, they have a career. They develop, their skills increase, they start managing other people, they have vision and insight into what it is they're doing. And it felt really important for me that we needed to recognise that professionalism. Yes, it's at a different academic achievement level, but it's about recognising that these people are as professional as you and I are, Steve. They care about what they do, they want to have an input to the industry, and actually our industry cannot function without them, so our industry should be embracing them and saying, bring your perspective, bring your insight to this.
So where's the value in that qualification? Is the value derived by more by the individual that's receiving it, or by the employer in terms of, right, they picked up certain skills as they've achieved that qualification? Or is it more from the point of view of the client wanting to see somebody who's got that qualification? Where's the balance there? And
there's benefit for everybody you've listed there. You know, why do we do it? We do it with this productivity piece. Our people definitely improve and they definitely get better. They get more skilled. There are fewer defects. There's more productivity. But it also takes them into a professional environment where they're attached to a professional association, an institution that gives them access to a network of learning. So their ability to satisfy their own thirst for learning is there. They might not take all of the opportunities, but the opportunities are there. So they can pick up on things, they can learn and grow. And as an individual, that moves them into a different place. Otherwise, those institutions are closed to them. They can't access them, or it's very difficult for them to access. And it's not automatic for them to go and think about, how would I find this information? How would I learn? Who can I speak to? What other individuals are in this circumstance?
Yeah, I think we've still got a long way to go in terms of RoJEP getting the recognition by the rest of the industry. So not just the geotechnical industry, but clients as well. So we're getting them to actually start asking for people with those qualifications. At some point, we will reach a tipping point. I know as every year goes by, there's more people that get onto that register of ground engineering professionals. And people will start to look for that certainly in major project procurement. I think it's any public sector scheme over 10 million has to use the balanced scorecard approach. one of those aspects will be training. There's clearly a lot of the topics that you've talked about now are going to be on there. So it'd be interesting to see how they might evaluate that. With something like ethics, for instance, I think this question that was presented actually to me on a LinkedIn forum the other day. How do people assess a company's ethics? Because, you know, you and I could have a conversation. You think, oh, Steve's got great ethics, and you know, I think likewise. But that doesn't necessarily mean, just because that director, that business leader's got it, that it translates throughout the business. So when it comes to evaluating, whether it be a supplier, a client, how can we understand what the ethics of a business rather than an individual are like?
I mean, that's a very direct question. I'm going to zoom back out and talk about this concept okay. as a whole, because it is very interesting indeed. You know, by knowing Steve, knowing how Steve is going to behave, do you know how Steve's business is going to behave? Now, the bigger that gets, the harder it is to say that the rest of the business will behave in the way that Steve desires. Steve may be the CEO, but even if you're the CEO, it doesn't necessarily follow that all your people will follow and do the things you do. So, you know, from a very, very obvious point of view, at some point you have to explain to your own people what it is that you want them to do. You have to explain the performance standard you're looking for. You have to explain to them the ethical standard that they're looking for. So we sometimes talk about values in that context. That gets very complicated because every business these days has values, and some of them are fantastic and really, you know, relate to what the organisation does, and some of them are, you know, the paper equivalent of, they're written down, but they don't necessarily reflect how the organisation responds. How do you know what the ethics of a business is? I think you have to understand the business in detail. So you have to spend some time working with it, and you have to understand what its track record looks like. But that's not a very satisfactory answer, because for most customers, that's very, very difficult to do. You've either worked with the organisation or you haven't. And saying that you will only work with organisations you've worked with before denies a whole aspect of the supply chain to you that you would otherwise have access to. The zoom out moment, I guess, for this is that in the past, government as a principal procurer, but also private procurers, have said, okay, instead of just doing price competitions, we will do price quality competitions. And we're all very familiar with those. What tends to happen is the quality aspect is a threshold rather than a test. So as long as you pass the minimum test on, or minimum threshold on safety, on quality performance, on defects remediation, on sustainability, whatever it is, you've passed the quality part. And then the question is, well, let's now go and talk about money. And it becomes a money competition again. What's changing within central government and sophisticated procurement is this idea that, no, you have to score, let's call it, the quality aspects of a bid alongside and integrated with the money part, so that you are placing a material differentiator within the quality part. So it's no longer good enough to say, well, you know, Steve's got an IF of 0.5, Alistair's got an IF of 0.6. They're both more or less in the park. That's fine. Having an IF of 0.5 is better than 0.6. Your safety performance is better. That should count for something. That should make a material difference. Similarly, your commitment to decarbonisation in your organisation. If you are running largely electrified plant or using biodiesels or whatever it is, that you've made a serious commitment as an organisation towards that. Government declared a climate emergency. We have national targets on reducing carbon in society. Procurement of public sector schemes particularly must follow that kind of thinking in order to make sure that the stuff we procure feeds towards that target rather than just being a sideshow. So you can add to that all the long list of things that we are interested in. So we're interested in diversity. I mean, gender diversity is a very clear point. We report annually on gender diversity, as every organisation does. And the reason that gender diversity is important for us is because the imbalance compared with society is so great. There are other groups. So when we talk about disability, when we talk about sexuality, when we talk about race and ethnicity, those groups are differently represented in our organisation as well. But there's a different dynamic there. They tend to be minority populations in the whole of society, whereas women are more or less an equal part of society. You know, they are 50% of society, more or less. It's ridiculous that our industry isn't able to represent that.
Well, it's 11%, I believe, of the construction industry, and on site, well, certainly in the piling industry, it's less than 1%. So we've got a long way to go. And I know you've spoken out about gender equality. In fact, I think I read somewhere you won an award, Man of the Year for wasn't it?
Some people say it's Man of the Year. It was WISE Man. So WISE is the Women in Science and Engineering. It's an absolutely fantastic organisation that I've been working with, and we've been working with as an organisation for a number of years. They really are very good, practical providers of advice to organisations that know they want to do something but aren't sure what to do. Because this is more difficult than everybody thinks. If it was simple, we'd have got there by now. But you know, this idea that you just go and employ more women, well, some people have tried that. And what happens is these women come into an environment that is relatively hostile to them, that is, you know, sometimes slightly misogynistic, certainly quite patronising, and of course that's not a very pleasant environment, so they tend not to stay in that environment. It is important that you deal with the culture first, and the numbers will come. Now, that needs something that happens simultaneously. You definitely need more women in our business. What you find is you need women at every level in our business, not just in the boardroom, but working on our projects, operating our equipment. It's a really interesting thing around construction. It's difficulties with gender pay gap, for example, are deeply structural. They're not about the fact that we pay women less than men. It's not that at all. It's that we don't have enough women, full stop, in construction. People often ask, well, why do you want more women in construction? Does it add anything to construction? And the answer is palpably yes. You know, there's a talent pool that we aren't tapping there. In the midst of a skills crisis and the impending shutdown of access to non-UK labour, clearly we have a skills crisis and a skills shortage, and this helps us address that. But more than that, it brings a whole sort of different outlook on the way that the relations in organisations work. So when you have single gender organisations of any type, male or female, you tend to find extremes of behaviour. And you certainly see that in construction. We're quite an antagonistic industry. We like a fight. We get in amongst that and we start fighting with each other and writing letters and all that good stuff. Organisations that don't have that macho culture are better at finding good consensus and ways forward. And that the data around that are incontrovertible. Organisations that are mixed gender and better balanced perform better in achieving their outcomes.
Well, you'll get a diversity of views, won't you? And I think just by increasing the talent pool as well, you've got a better chance of getting better quality people in each position. Whereas if we just say, right, we're not going to pick from half of the population, then you're dramatically in reducing your potential to get the best possible people working for your business. So,
of course, as an industry, we make lots of mistakes, and that's mistakes are absolutely forgivable, but it's important that you learn from them. So one of the things we go through is this idea that we have to turn women into replicates of men. We have to make them more assertive and more angry and more confrontational. Well, actually, the benefit of diversity in an organisation is the difference. If you try and turn everybody into the same thing, then you lose the benefit that you're trying to find. I often hear when I talk with groups of employees, often young men actually, because quite often you'll find groups of young men who are quite nervous about this idea of increasing gender diversity in organisations. Somebody somewhere has suggested to them that if you bring women in, men have to leave. Well, that's not the case. It's not one in, one out. There is something we do that brings additional capacity to the organisation that grows us. But one of the comments that you get from that group of people is that it wouldn't be right to put an underqualified woman into a senior position. And that's true. That's certainly a thing we don't aim to do. We want to make sure that anybody going into a position is well qualified. But to be absolutely honest, you know, my response to that is, well, you know, slightly ironically, we've never done that with a man, have we? And of course, it is ridiculous to say that we're going to try and find somebody just because they're a woman and put them in a role. What we're looking for is to broaden the pool, absolutely maximise the capability of these women, bring them into our organisation and use that capability. And it is all there. It's definitely happening. Yeah, good news, Steve, just because I like talking about this, the good news is that within our industry, within ground engineering, not only do we have access to civil engineers who are typically going through university at the rate of 3 men to 1 woman, but we have access to earth scientists who are more like 1 to 1 in courses at university, courses in colleges, and are developing. Where we miss out is in our trades workforce, who are almost to a person male.
We've also got to change the environment, the working hours. I know you've worked with Timewise on projects that look at the working hours and the shift patterns. Just want to explain how that worked within BAM for me.
Yeah, you've touched on something that's really interesting. The answer to this, as I said, is not that you just employ more women. The barriers to this are fundamentally working practices and what I call job design. So how we think about the roles that we have in our organisation. So the working practices one, typically working hours, is complicated. You know, we, as an organisation, the work that we do tends not to be in our backyard, so you end up having to travel towards it. We can't really do an awful lot about that geography. We have got into the habit of working 10-hour days, sometimes 12-hour days. We know that that doesn't add productivity. We know that that damages safety. And we know that it excludes a population that have caring responsibilities or other responsibilities that mean they cannot be in a location for 10 or 12 hours each day. And we also have, you know, long hours culture, which sometimes sees us working significant overtime in premium shifts, tidal shifts and things like that, or working at weekends or working odd shift patterns. Now, all of those are a reality of construction just now. The geography, we struggle to do an awful lot with, but the other things are constructs of the way that we have set up our industry, and it's within our gift to decide we want to do something different. In February, when I was talking with project directors about the need to do something different, the answer was, I get it, I understand the benefit, but it's impossible, we can't do this. By April, we were doing it, and the reason, of course, was COVID. We couldn't have people on projects. So what did we end up doing on projects? A group of people who felt that they absolutely had to be on a project in February to do their work suddenly found that they didn't absolutely have to be on a project to do their work. So planners, people preparing commercial settlements, all that sort of thing. There are large quantities of the work that don't require you to be an artisan sitting on the site. And so those can be done flexibly. They can be done from a different location. They can be done at different times, provided you meet the performance standards and the deadlines that you need. That doesn't mean you have to be there 12 hours a day, you know, turning up at 7 o'clock, drinking a cup of tea until 8 o'clock, having a chat, getting on with it. Now, of course, everybody works hard in our industry. It is a truth that ours is a difficult industry to work in, but not all of the 10 or 12 hours that are spent on site are necessarily productive.
No, well, one of the things that we did fairly early on was to say, because we have a lot of people that travel from Essex into London to work, and usually they're doing a long shift, so door to door it might be sort of five in the morning until sort of getting home at 7 o'clock at night. What we said was, well, we don't want you having break times together, so let's take out the breaks, so just do a 6-hour shift, which is basically what you can do without a break, and just work through. So they were finishing very early, but they're, you looked at the production levels, and it's very easy for us to do this in the piling industry, probably a lot easier than some of the other trades, because we just look at the total amount of concrete that we poured, or the linear meters of piles that we've installed. And we could see that there wasn't much loss in terms of what we were producing from a 6-hour shift compared to what we were producing from a 9 or a 10-hour shift with breaks in there, because you've got the disruption. All right, you might be having a 25-minute break at 10 o'clock in the morning and a 40-minute one at lunchtime. But with the downtime you've got before and after the break, that amounted to quite a bit of disruption. I think we all know we get fatigued through the day, so the production drops towards the end of the shift anyway. So actually, that could be a really good solution to address the shorter working hours. We might have to do that by saying one shift doing 6 hours in the morning and another shift doing 6 hours in the afternoon. And then what that needs is the client to buy into that by providing the site opening hours sufficiently. We need the councils to buy into it. We need local communities. There's lots of people that have got to come together in order that construction can change, but we need to talk about it more so people can understand the problems and solutions.
Isn't that interesting how that comes around? A lot of what you did within our sites, particularly in London, was about trying to help people avoid peak time travel on public transport. So you start moving the shift and also minimising the number of people physically on the project any one time. So you started having staggered shifts that started either earlier in the day or later in the day and finished on a non-peak time so that people could travel non-peak. And you, you know, you suddenly get to this understanding that it is possible for a project to run without there being a mastermind in place all the time that's there. We see this with, you know, with rail projects. When you make the suggestion that it's possible for there to be a job shared project director role, for example, normally that meets with a gasp of horror and, well, that's impossible. How could that be? And then you say, okay, when we get a 72-hour blockade on the railway, is there one project director who stands over that job in 72 hours? No, of course there isn't. There's two, sometimes three people who are overall responsible for delivery of that job, delivery on the ground, and they organise amongst themselves. And we know how to do that. So that's straightforward. Yeah. I mean, other barriers to this, still a significant proportion of people working in the construction industry are hourly paid. So when you move to these designs that say, look, let's work more effectively with more productivity and reduce the hours, as an industry, we definitely need to do something to make sure that those individuals are not disadvantaged from that, that they don't end up being poorer because we are trying to make something better. There needs to be a rethink about some of the employment models that we have in construction to make sure that we, if you like, that we are focused on outcomes rather than the relentless focus on input cost.
Sorry, you might hear a bit of noise in the background. I'm working from home currently and got a couple of little ones trying to get in the room at the moment. So I've managed to barricade myself in with the use of a guitar amp. And
you're doing very well in that case. But, you know, this whole period has been really interesting for us as an organisation, but as a society, this realisation that there are different ways of doing the things that we've traditionally taken for granted. It presents us with some fairly big questions to answer. So should people come to work? Should they not come to work? Should people travel on public transport in the way they did before? Is, you know, a lot of our public transport demand was driven by peak load. Is that now a thing? Is it not a thing? Will it come back? Will it not? So there's some really interesting things there. But yeah, I suppose coming back to that point around you know, how people are paid in construction and making sure that you end up with the right sort of outcomes, back to that overall purpose-led business piece, the purpose of what we do in construction is to provide things that make society better, that make real life better for real people. So it's completely counterintuitive that we would do that in a way that damages the well-being of our own people, the wealth of our own people, the health of our own people. So we need to think very carefully about what those employment models in construction are and deal with some of the very real issues in society that we've got just now, that, you know, inequality of wealth, for example. Mm-hmm. As an industry, you must have these people in the same way that they exist in my own organisation. We take on a graduate from a university who starts as monthly salaried with a pension, with a car, with a laptop and all that sort of stuff, more or less at the drop of a hat. And we have people, tradespeople, who've been working in our organisation for more than 20 years who are still hourly paid, who are, you know, paid once a week an amount of money depending on how much work they did in the prior week. And that doesn't feel like a very realistic way to treat people. So a lot of what I did in Bam Ritchie's early on was to try and shift hourly paid employees into weekly salaried employees, so they were salaried, they received a salary. Now there's some big risks around, you know, fluctuating volumes of work in that, but it feels right to move people from an hour, you know, working hours and bonus culture to a performance and development culture by giving them a salary and saying, here's my expectations of outcome.
Yeah, I can see that being extremely challenging. So did you find difficulties in terms of getting the work done? Did productivity levels drop? Did profits drop when you initiated that sort of project?
No, not really. So I made it voluntary. So if you wanted it, you could ask for it, but you could only go one way. You couldn't go to become weekly staff for a period of time and then say, actually, I know there's a big job kicking off and I'd prefer to get hours and bonus. That wasn't the deal. And actually what that means is the people who are interested start to talk to you about it. You can explain what it is you're trying to do and why you think it's beneficial. And I would show them the calculation. This is what you've earned for the past 3 years. This is what it looks like week by week. And of course, there are some fantastic weeks there. There are weeks where you've worked 12 hours a day for 6 days and you've taken home a huge amount of money and a bonus. But most of your weeks are not like that. And some of your weeks are definitely not like that. So a salary, it doesn't give you those super peaks, but it does mean in a quieter time, you've got something that you can rely on to take home.
So how did you manage the situation, which must have arisen, where they do need to do a 12-hour day? And how much reluctance was there from the individual to do that in that particular scenario, as clearly they wouldn't get any additional money?
It doesn't take long for people to figure out that this is definitely a better arrangement, to be salaried, to know what you're going to earn, to be able to have that reliably coming in every week. And of course, there is overtime. It's not you get the salary and there's nothing else, but it's not premium overtime. And there are other benefits that come from it. But the principal thing that actually happens, Steve, is that those individuals get into that mindset and stop thinking about how many hours can I work today, or what can I put in my timesheet, or what's the bonus going to be? And instead of wasting their time thinking about that and wasting mental capacity trying to figure out how do I max out this week, they spend their time thinking about their work and thinking about how the work can be done better. And those are the ones that they sort of self-select for personal improvement. They self-select onto a career path, which means that they develop through, and become, quite often in a number of instances, I can point to individuals who've grown up, go through that route into foreman, general foreman, into work supervisors, works managers, and end up in very responsible operational positions within the business because they stopped thinking about how to max out for number one and they start thinking about how can I make this business work better?
Just before we came on air, we were talking about sickness benefit as well, enduring sickness, which traditionally in the construction industry has not been there for people that earn a weekly wage, so that they're paid by the hour. If they don't come in, they don't get any sickness pay, regardless of what's happened. But I believe you've looked at different approaches to dealing with that as well, haven't you?
Yeah. So if you look at statutory sick pay, I don't know if you how recently you've looked at that, Steve, but it's horrific.
Yeah.
It is not enough to live on, basically, in the modern world. As an organisation, you feel you've got a responsibility to these people. What happens with your employees tends to be that if they are ill, you tend to be resistant to the idea of them going on to statutory sick pay because you know it is so low. So we're generally speaking very generous with people, but of course it's quite a precarious existence. And it's a group of people who, when they are sick, start to worry very quickly about losing their job, losing their livelihood, unable to feed the family, all the things that are very, very real and very rational fears for people in that circumstance. So, while if you're hourly paid, you can earn a great deal of money if you're working on a very large project, working long hours, it's extremely precarious. If you suddenly can't do that, for example, you become injured, then the risk is you lose what was quite a comfortable income and you lose it very quickly indeed. So, we've been looking at all sorts of things around how can we provide that? A company insurance scheme around those individuals to change the shift from the transition, if you like, from working salary through into sickness pay. But also, how can those individuals make sure that they are covered, that they've got some insurance cover for that? And as we were saying earlier on, actually, that's surprisingly modest. And as a salary cost or an additional salary cost for something that removes, in large part, the precariousness of individuals' employment, that feels like a really good deal. What is the benefit for the business? Well, it's definitely the case that people do come back. People who are injured tend to want to rush back to work and earn, and sometimes come back in a way that they shouldn't come back. And we definitely want to discourage that. We want people to be well before they come back because it's better for them and it's definitely better for them.
Well, particularly at the moment with COVID. So if you've got people coming in that might be sick, they might be spreading the disease amongst their colleagues. How big a part of the COVID spread has this sort of payment practice been? It could be really significant. People have got to go out and earn money for their, for the benefit of their families. Yeah, unless we sort of change the way that we're looking after people, then we're going to potentially be facing this in the future again.
And I think when you look at that hourly paid working practice, I mean, there are parts of the industry that absolutely believe in it and believe it is the way forward. So tunnelling, for example, it is traditionally very difficult to talk to tunnelling crews about anything other than production-related bonus and hours. Mm. In the round, you look at it, and if an individual is motivated to work hours, they're paid by the hour, then it is very difficult to align that with output and productivity, and it's impossible to align it with an industry that is trying to reduce its working hour, its long working hours culture. It is diametrically opposite from the intention of an industry that wants to reduce its working hours culture. But it also makes the whole change or the whole piece of precariousness a real problem. So this wealth inequality that we talked about a little bit earlier on, there aren't many people working in construction who are at a real poverty line because construction roles, particularly trades working agreement rates for roles, have been improving But there's still significant difference between what are traditionally considered professional roles and trades roles. And as an industry, working in society, doing things that are for the benefit of society, there is definitely an opportunity for us to make some of those working arrangements and some of those roles less precarious and less short-term than they are just now.
Just picking up on the point there about tunnelling, I mean, tunnelling's as a sector or subsector, that's an industry that's tended to use agency workers more. I don't know where you get at BAM get your workers from, or whether they're mainly directly employed. But of course, agency workers are also going to have problems in this regard, and whether through their agencies or, you know, take it upon themselves. I think that's also something that we, as an industry, we need to be looking at to make sure they've got continuity of income.
And again, we talked about this quite a lot at the time that I was chair. We were interested in, you know, what is the industry looking for from agency providers? We absolutely need them. There is a sort of flex in demand that you can't necessarily cover by having just direct employed skills. Certainly my view on the direct skills point is that I really like direct employment because it breeds great safety culture, great quality culture, commitment to the business and understanding. And you can engage people in that purpose-led business piece. That is obviously more difficult with external labour that's coming in, but it's a real need for the industry. So my next question then becomes, well, how do you make sure that the employment practices in agency labour are correct, are honest, are fair? And how do you start to deal with the issue of being paid by the hour versus paid on the basis of output? And I have to tell you, that is incredibly difficult with agency labour because fundamentally you are paying by the hour. So it then moves into a place where you have to talk very, very meaningfully about the operating culture you're looking for and the outputs you're looking for. Sometimes that slips into productivity bonuses, and I have a bit of a horror of productivity bonuses because, in my view, tend to drive the wrong behaviour. You end up with people achieving output at the expense of other things. But as we all know, anybody who's been involved in this part, there is no bonus scheme that works perfectly. And there's no bonus scheme that allows you to capture every aspect of what you think good business practice ought to look like. So the only way you can meaningfully do that is to talk to people, remind them again and again, engage them in it, bring their input to it, get them emotionally invested in the idea of a good thing being done. You know, just keep working at that to do it. If it was easy, Steve, we'd be doing it all the time.
We actually stopped probably 5 or 6 years ago our bonuses within our business and absorb them into our rates of pay because it just became too difficult to manage. It was encouraging the wrong behaviour. And it went down extremely well. Overall, we've not seen a deterioration in productivity. And in fact, our production levels have improved over the last few years by spending more time with people, being very clear about the goals that we want, being realistic about them as well, and getting feedback from the site crews about what we can actually achieve on a particular project, but being clear on the expectations from the business and then working with individuals that perhaps aren't quite meeting what we would expect of them. So there are a different and more progressive ways, I think, to deal with that in the future.
What you've just described to me, Steve, is that performance and development culture. I mean, that is absolutely a perfect example. And, you know, it is brilliant that you've done that. I think a lot of businesses, mine included, struggle with the idea of getting rid of bonuses because it's so embedded. But objectively, I can't see any arguments for them. I don't like them. I don't like the way they work. They don't give me what I need. Why would you carry on with them? Some of them end up just being an attendance bonus, basically. It's paid because you turn up.
Yeah, pick up on that point about the agencies again. Just for the listeners' benefit, really, there is a group that has now been established. It was one of the FPS's strategic aims this year, and it was a result of the Occupational Health and Wellbeing Charter that we set up to look at labour agency best practice guidance. The group's meeting for the second time today, hope to be working with some of the major agencies in the country to explain what we expect from them and what they should expect from us. So we've got a better understanding of how people are being looked after, what experience they've got, what machines they've been operating, making sure that they're getting regular training and so on. I can't list everything now because the working group's still going on, but the results of that group should be shared with the industry over the next few months. Let's look at one other area before we let you go. Sustainable development and decarbonisation is really important to, well, to everybody in the world, but we're starting to become more conscious about it as an industry. How do you deal with that, when the plant that we're using is so heavy, the concrete that we use has got such high CO2 emissions, yeah, you know, related to that? How are you trying to drive it down within BAM, and do you have any big targets for yourself as a business?
So BAM finds this as difficult as everybody else. You know, are we committed to the idea of decarbonisation, radical decarbonisation? Yes, we are. But you're absolutely right. It's a truth that almost all the things that are produced in construction involve in large part concrete and steel, both massively heavy embedded carbon content. You know, what creates that? There's so many things out there. It's an established material. It's understood. Designers know how to design with it. Insurers like it because it's proven, so it can be warranted. There are so many things that make it attractive to carry on doing the things we've been doing and using the materials we've been using. So where do you go with it? Well, one of the things that we found within BAM in the UK particularly was that liquid fuel usage, diesel usage, was a really significant part of our carbon footprint. And we went to have a look at liquid fuel usage, and we discovered that about a third of it was going into mobile generator sets to power site compounds. So to provide electricity that could otherwise be provided by the mains. Now, sometimes getting a mains connection takes a bit of time and it can be a bit awkward, but we were using fuel, burning fuel, to provide electricity that could be provided in a significantly lower carbon way through a mains connection. Mm-hmm. So we've ended up with a very big focus on reduction in liquid fuel use, not least because it's expensive, but it is, you know, you're burning a hydrocarbon and it releases CO2 at a really significant density. And that's been a major piece of how can we reduce what we call our own Scope 1, Scope 2 emissions, which is the emissions for which we have immediate control over. Scope 3 emissions, the things like concrete and steel, where somebody else tells us this is what you have to build, and we end up buying those materials and building them in, that is much more difficult, and that requires an industry way of thinking about this. So some organisations, and amongst them FPS members, looking very hard at low-carbon concretes. They're not zero carbon, but they're low carbon. Mm-hmm. Those are good steps forward. I guess I have a feeling that we will reach a point quite quickly where we understand that alternative material science is necessary in this, and that we start to do something. I have a very particular research interest myself through the University of Strathclyde around biomaterials and how we use biomaterials in an engineering sense. They tend to be significantly lower carbon, sometimes zero carbon. And what's interesting about them is that we can replicate in some part either strengths of materials that we otherwise engineer or the properties of materials that we otherwise engineer. So slope stability, for example, using biogrowth as a way to stabilise rather than using plastic mats or using embedded engineered elements. Now, there's a lot of work goes on around that sort of thing all over the world. But it does feel like our industry needs to move quite quickly in that direction in order to make sure that we are able to move away from steel and concrete just being the only story for tomorrow. You see some really clever stuff with low volume, high efficiency manufacturing. So 3D printing of concrete is a perfect example of that. We've opened a 3D printing factory in Eindhoven where we make 3D elements. What's interesting about that is, number one, you remove some waste. You're not forming with formwork as we do on construction sites, so you remove the waste that comes from formwork. But what's most interesting is that you can combine it with a parametric design approach, which allows you to take a design model, a stress-based model, change it to the circumstances of the thing you're trying to create. Let's say it's a bridge. The parameters are created by the new geometry that you've done, and the design auto-generates. And you very quickly are able to see where material is required and where it's not required. And with a 3D printing technique, you can put the material where it's required rather than just filling up a big box full of concrete and saying, well, I know some of this concrete's working harder than the rest of it. With 3D printing, we can create the shapes where we put the working concrete in the place where it needs to work and leave the rest of the place either as voids or we can fill them. You know, it's a relatively immature technology still. We're using it in commercial projects, but it's not yet at a scale where you run it across all of our business, just because, in large part, it's not well understood and it's hard for designers to design with. So a lot of our effort goes into helping designers understand how they can use these materials and how they can use that manufacturing process.
Yeah, I think I saw something on one of your LinkedIn posts. It was, I think it was a walkway.
Yeah, that's right.
Which with a curved. So how on earth would you print that? It's still made of concrete, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, well, it's a sort of mortar rather than concrete. It is built up. It's a robot arm. I could probably link you to a video that you could show to the listeners.
Okay.
But it's a robot arm that literally prints this layer by layer and just builds it up and builds it up. So, you know, we can build things that are of significant height, of significant length, and you build them as elements and the elements come together. But, of course, the clever part of this is with digital design, we can build these things before we build them. We model them. We get them in the right shape, size. We do the design for manufacture and assembly parts, which is the really clever piece here, and then you print the elements and build it as you've designed it. So we've been building bridges, for example, where you build the, you manufacture the elements up to 10 meters long, up to 2 meters in width, and then you can assemble those components on a project site. What's arriving is like precast concrete. So it arrives,
wow. It's
strong, you tension it together, and you're there. So we have we've got bridges in the Netherlands. We've got cycle bridges. We've got everything from garden furniture to plant pot holders to the walls, the retaining walls that you've seen on the station at Driebergen Zeist. It's a real technology. It needs to find its application, I would say.
You're blowing my mind with that. I can understand how you can print paper or like plastic, but yeah, the idea that you could print concrete and be able to control it without it just sort of slopping away and going wherever it wants. It takes some getting my head around that.
So the clever part, you know, the material science is an extremely clever part of that, making sure that the mortar is the right material, that it's printable in its fluid form, that it's stiff enough to maintain that form, and that it gets the kind of strength and properties that we expect from an engineering material. But the other clever parts are the design for manufacture and assembly, you know, figuring out what you are actually going to print, but also then the parametric design or the design element that says this is how you design for this material and this manufacturing method, rather than just saying it's a lump of concrete, just like every other lump of concrete. It is different, and you do need to think about it differently.
In terms of concrete, we've just recorded a podcast. It's not been released yet, Alistair, so you wouldn't have heard it, but with a couple of guys from Hansen Concrete, and we were discussing on their lower carbon concrete. So if any of the listeners are interested in that, then please check that one out. It should be the number before Alistair's on the podcast list. You make a really important point there about the fuel usage on site, and you're saying you're using a lot of diesel generators. What we've got to do is make sure we're talking to local authorities and to power suppliers about sites extremely early on, and making sure that there is electric supplied to the sites as soon as possible. Because let's face it, there's now some technology out there so there are electric piling rigs. Libra have got one. Yeah. There's more on their way. There's electric diggers. There's electric cherry pickers. There's electric dumpers. All of these things are available, but unless we've got a way of getting a large electric supply to site, then all of this equipment is redundant, really. So for me, the infrastructure challenge is probably as big as the technological challenge of being able to find electric plants and equipment.
I agree, yeah, but I would say that I think electricity is not the only answer to this. So the for example, in the Netherlands, we have just electrified a road roller, a ride-on road roller, large unit for roadworks, and it's perfectly possible to take something, a prime mover like that, and electrify it. For a piling rig, it is more difficult. The electrical demand is significant, and the energy required for running that machine is big. For me, it feels more likely that we'll end up with piling rigs slightly different because they're more static, but for larger pieces of equipment, larger prime movers, hydrogen as the prime motive fuel for that. But we've got to be pretty careful with hydrogen because it is not carbon-free to produce, or it's not energy-free to produce, and you've got to make sure that energy balance is correct, that you're paying attention to that rather than just switching over for the sake of switching over. I think above all, we've got to make sure that we minimise energy consumption. So when we're talking about project site compounds, it's not just about getting rid of diesel generators. It's about making sure that the cabins are thermally efficient, that we're not wasting heat, that they are using LED lighting rather than fluorescent lighting. We use, for example, what we call solartainers, which are solar panel containers with a large battery backup pack inside. It gets charged, but a small backup generator. And those provide exactly the same kind of power outputs as large diesel generators do, and give us the power requirement that we need for running projects. Because, of course, our projects are they're pretty static. You can set these kind of things up. You can set up banks of them and provide renewable energy for your site compound just as easily as renting a generator. Yeah. Are they more expensive? Yes, they can be, but they don't take any diesel. And that's the thing that everybody needs to factor in. You know, the running cost of these is significantly lower than pouring red diesel into generators.
And of course, the localised workforce, which is where we came in talking about the social aspects and reduced working hours. You know, if we can get people local to the job, being able to do the job, then there's a reduced carbon effect from the scheme. That, I think, is a really brilliant wide-ranging discussion. If at this point you want to bring in anything else, then
Well, let me just drag you back to this purpose-led business. All of the topics we talked about today, Steve, are very tied into this idea. You know, so when the purpose of our industry is to create sustainable environments that enhance people's lives, that's what we say at BAM, but that's really what it is. We're about creating the environment for society to flourish. The idea that we do that as an industry in a way that is unsustainable, that increases carbon emissions in the world, that costs more energy than or uses energy that can't be produced renewably, that damages the people who are either going to be the end users of these products or who are building them, all of that stuff is completely counterintuitive if you're thinking about how do you as an organisation and as an industry improve society. And you can add on to that the financial aspects, you can add on to that this shareholder, stakeholder capitalism piece that we were talking about earlier. We make good money as an industry when we do good work. We don't do good work because we make good money. We make good money and we make success and we make sustainable business success when we produce really high quality work that fulfills the demands of society. And that's the piece that brings it all together. Why do you do this? Because it works for society and it works for business. Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure. I rarely get the opportunity to talk at this length with somebody so engaging. So thanks very much indeed for the opportunity to speak.
As I mentioned to you in my email a little while ago, you know, we do miss you within the FPS and miss your insight. And
that's very kind. I miss you guys too.
Thank you. Thank you. That was great, wasn't it? As always, I want to thank you for listening, and particular thanks for your engagement this year. We didn't know if podcasts were going to work, but in the environment that we found ourselves in, they proved a really effective way to communicate with people. We've delivered some really key messages to the industry and had some great feedback too. This will be the last podcast of 2020. Happy Christmas, stay safe, and I look forward to seeing and hearing from you in the new year. Thank you. Bye-bye.